G'day, yes, it is time for The Third Degree with me, Simon Unwin. I hope you're having a lovely spring morning. Today we're going to be looking at the arguments for and against Australia's renewable energy target, which currently aims us to have us producing 20% of our power from renewables by 2020. And later on in the show, we'll also hear about the twofold threat to the Great Barrier Reef posed by a new coal mining rush getting underway in Queensland. First today, Australia's federally mandated renewable energy target is currently under review, and there's been some very vocal submissions into that review recommending that the target itself be scrapped as a costly duplication of the carbon tax. To talk this over, I'm joined by Tim Sonreich. Tim is the Strategic Policy Manager at the Clean Energy Council, which is the peak body for the clean energy industry. Tim, as I'm sure you're well aware, the federal government's currently reviewing the renewable energy target, and currently the aim is to have 20% renewable energy by 2020. And I suppose there's been the usual submissions into that review from, you know, fossil fuel lobby groups and so on. But more interestingly, we've seen certain state government bodies getting involved as well. In particular, recently we've seen IPART, the New South Wales pricing regulator, call for the abolition of the renewable energy target because they're concerned about the target adding unnecessary costs to energy bills, and that it's and they're saying it's basically unnecessary now that we have a carbon price. Now, how do you respond to that?
Well, firstly, I think that they're wrong on both counts. It's not the rate is complementary to a carbon price, and we can talk about that a bit more. And the costs are not unnecessary, and they're not particularly high. I understand that consumers are very concerned about the cost of electricity, and so am I, and so are we as a council, and we understand all of that and those pressures. But the renewable energy target really has very little to do with the electricity price rises that we've seen over the last 3 or 4 years. And in fact, as a proportion of people's electricity bills, the renewable energy target makes up about 7% at the moment, and that will fall actually to about 4% by 2020 at the end of the scheme. So it's really not a major driver of cost.
In terms of the argument being made, that I suppose coming from a lot of quarters, that the renewable energy target, you know, that scheme is incompatible with the carbon price and I suppose the emissions trading scheme later on down the track. Now, why are they making this argument that it's incompatible? And I guess what's your reasoning in saying that the two things can run in tandem quite easily?
Well, I think their argument, to be fair to them, is that under the carbon price and the emissions trading scheme that's been passed by the federal parliament, there's a national emissions cap, and that's to reduce emissions by 5% by 2020. And so their argument is that underneath that cap, it doesn't really matter whether you generate emissions abatement by having renewable energy or by being energy efficient or by reducing waste or, you know, any one of the thousands of things that you can do to reduce emissions. Everything just contributes to that 5% cap. So therefore, we don't need to do the renewable energy target to get abatement. And our response to that is, well, that's technically true that you don't necessarily need the renewable energy target to get to 20%, to get to a 5% reduction by 2020. If you want to have renewable energy in Australia, and all the polling that everyone's done says that renewable energy is fantastically popular and people want us to have more renewable energy, and they're right to think that renewable energy is a good thing for a whole variety of reasons, and emissions reduction is only one of them, then you have to have the renewable energy target because the carbon price on its own is simply insufficient to get wind projects and large solar projects off the ground.
The suggestion is then from you that those market forces sort of put into place by the carbon price and the emissions trading scheme aren't by themselves going to push investment in renewable energy?
No, and the federal government recognises that, and that's why they're spending about half of the revenue that's generated by the carbon price on things like the Clean Energy Finance Corporation and the Australian Renewable Energy Organisation and Arena. So it recognises that simply the carbon price on its own isn't enough, and so they're funneling half of that revenue back into trying to support renewable energy programs, and we support that. But the single most successful program that we've ever had in Australia, both for supporting renewable energy and for reducing emissions, has been the renewable energy target. So it's the best thing we've got. It's the best thing we're going to have over the next few years while the carbon price is low and is really not aimed at sort of transforming the energy system in the first few years. So now would be a terrible time to scrap the renewable energy target.
I suppose some of the things that we've been hearing from, we talked about New South Wales, the IPART agency there before, but we've also heard from the Queensland government, and they're suggesting that increased investment in renewable energy actually doesn't necessarily result in carbon abatement. They're saying their coal plants have to keep running at more or less the same level. I mean, it's that familiar sort of baseload power argument. Now, how do you respond to that?
Well, it's interesting. The Queensland government's argument seems to be, as far as we can tell, and we have a pretty good relationship with them, seems to be based on some reporting that was done in the Australian newspaper a couple of days ago, which itself was based on a report done by a retired engineer who created some spreadsheets with some data that he put together, which he believed argued that that coal-fired power stations weren't reducing their consumption of coal in response to wind farms. So it's not actually based on work done by governments or work done by the sort of standard consulting models. It's done by a well-intentioned retired bloke who's got a bit of time on his hands who crunched some numbers and came up with what he thinks is the answer. And the simple fact is that it's wrong, that the amount of coal-fired electricity that's produced in Australia has gone down in proportion as renewable energy has gone up, and it's simply not the case that coal-fired power stations can only run at one speed, and they have to run flat out all the time, and if they don't run flat out all the time, there are some terrible economic and social consequences. That's just not true. Coal-fired power plants don't have the same flexibility that a gas-fired power station has, for example, but they can and do run at different capacities all the time, even before there were large penetrations of wind. They respond to market conditions, and sometimes demand is higher than at other times, and coal-fired power plants simply don't run flat out all the time. That's just a myth.
Okay, so I guess to move on to yet another plank in the argument against the renewable energy target that we're sort of hearing at the moment is that the renewable energy target distorts the market, the energy market in Australia, and actually discourages investment in what some people are calling low emissions technology. Now, I'm quoting there an argument in The Australian again, but it was from someone from the Australian Coal Association. Now, I'd be interested to hear your thoughts on that argument.
This is probably my favourite argument of all, to criticise the renewable energy target, as Nikki Williams did from the Australian Coal Association today. And she wrote in her opinion piece that what's not well understood about the renewable energy target is that it distorts the investment market. Well, of course it distorts the investment market. It's a program designed to encourage renewable energy into a market that would otherwise not have an economic incentive to build renewable energy. To suggest that it's somehow strange or an unanticipated outcome that quote-unquote distorts the market is extremely strange, like suggesting that medicine distorts the path of a disease. Well, of course it does. It's there to change the outcome from what it otherwise would have been without it. So it's absolutely the case that renewable energy, through the renewable energy target, has changed investment decisions in the energy market. That's exactly what it's designed to do.
How's it feeling us at the moment to have to be defending the renewable energy target against all of this all of these ideas, when relatively recently it would have been seen as a fairly unimpeachable part of the government's emissions abatement programs?
Well, that's true. It's always been a bipartisan policy at a federal level, and it remains that way. We have dealings with the federal coalition on a regular basis, and they tell us both publicly and privately that they're still strong supporters of the renewable energy target. You know, in fact, the first renewable energy target in Australia, the AMRET, was created by John Howard. And then it was expanded by Kevin Rudd in a way that was at a time that was supported by the opposition as well. So it's always been a bipartisan policy. It's always been something that both sides of politics have collaborated on. And at least at a federal level, it remains that way. We're just starting to see a couple of the new state governments start to reinvent the position of their party on some of these issues. And I guess what's most strange about this is that even if you accept the argument that we have a carbon price now and that's supposed to do the job of reducing emissions and everything else is unnecessary, it's generally the people making that argument who themselves oppose the carbon price and don't think it should remain. So given that there is significant uncertainty at the moment about who will win the next federal election and whether or not, if there's a change in government, that new government will be able to remove the carbon price, as Tony Abbott's famously pledged to do, it would seem like the worst possible time to remove the renewable energy target on the grounds that it's not needed when you've got a carbon price.
Yeah, it's a fairly contradictory position to be holding.
It's a very strange position. Yeah, it doesn't seem to fit together. So I would have more sympathy for the argument if we get down the track and we find that there is a carbon price and it's working very well and it's driving investment and the renewable energy target is just completely redundant. But we're many years away from knowing whether there's going to continue to be a renewable energy target out to 2020 and how effective it's going to be in the case of supporting renewable energy. So it just seems like the wrong possible time to be drawing these conclusions, and it just seems a little self-serving from some of those groups.
I know that the review hasn't been completed yet, but do you foresee any change being made to the renewable energy target coming out of this review?
Look, we're taking this review incredibly seriously. The renewable energy target is the single most important and the single most effective tool that we've ever had in Australia to support renewable energy. So for our industry, it's the number one priority, you know, above everything else. So we're sort of throwing everything we've got at supporting it. But that said, I don't detect in Canberra any sort of great desire either from the government or the opposition to sort of tinker with the renewable energy target in any great way. Certainly, I think it's unlikely that the target will be repealed. But, you know, we can't take these things for granted, and we have to push as hard as we can to make sure that they're still there. And it's not even a question of whether the target's repealed or not. Even if there were significant changes made to the scheme, that could fundamentally undermine the investment environment that we're trying to create to kind of get the projects off the ground and get the target met. So our biggest fear is not that the target will be repealed. We think that's unlikely, but our biggest fear is that the target might be tinkered with, and that could have the unintended consequence of really slowing down the rate of investment. And we're at a very difficult time right now because we've had a number of state governments who have passed very restrictive planning laws to make it more difficult to build wind farms. We've already got banks who are uncertain about investing given the uncertainty that there is around the carbon price package and what that's going to mean in the next federal election. So it's a very nervous market out there, and it's an increasingly constrained market. And the last thing we need on top of that is for anyone to mess with what has been over the last 10 years a very stable, very bipartisan, very uncontroversial policy.
You must be also feeling a bit skittish given that other seemingly unimpeachable elements of the government's policies around this issue, like the buying out of the worst coal-fired power plants, for example. Some of those have actually, you know, have been wound back and taken off the table. So certainly I can understand why you're currently throwing everything you've got at it.
Well, particularly when there's so much misunderstanding amongst the community about why electricity prices are going up, and it's a very convenient scapegoat for people to point the finger and say, oh, it's those solar panels or it's the wind farms. But as I said, in total, the entire renewable energy target scheme, which is actually in two parts and supports large and small-scale renewable energy, only contributes 7% to people's electricity bills. And this is the highest contribution they'll ever make. All the modelling indicates that the cost will decline over the next few years, mostly because we've had a big rush in rooftop solar PV over the last year or so, and the costs of that are sort of catching up to us now. But with the change in policies at federal and state levels, that the pace of that will back off now, and the underlying costs of those technologies are coming down. So we're actually at the high water mark right now, and at that's worst. It's, you know, 7% of people's bills. The price rises we're seeing in the network, you know, poles and wires, cost of electricity, you know, that's the part of your bill that contributes 40% of your electricity. At the wholesale market level, increases in the cost of gas, increases in the cost of coal. I mean, gas tripled, is on track to triple along the East Coast. That makes up another 40% of your bill, and then there are other costs associated with the electricity retailers and their profit margins and what they need to operate. So when you take all of that and you ask yourself, should we be targeting 7%, which will one day be 4% of our bill, and focus all our attention on trying to cut people's bills, most people in the public wouldn't even notice that difference. And those costs in those other areas are just rising because of structural reasons which need to be addressed, which aren't related to renewable energy.
It's interesting to hear that we are sort of at the high watermark of government-supported investment in renewable energy driving prices up, because I suppose the experience, particularly in New South Wales, has been, we had this fantastically successful feed-in tariff, which almost in some ways, or according to a lot of people, got, you know, too successful for its own good, and that actually sort of wound back the generosity of the government's investment in that. But I suppose that there are other examples across the world where, you know, while it's driven the price of electricity up slightly, it's also reflected, I guess, a longer, you know, flatter trend.
Well, that's right. I mean, if you look at, New South Wales, in terms of their feed-in tariff, that was the sort of the worst example of costs kind of getting out of control. And I think everybody agrees that scheme was overly generous and could have been sort of wound back in stages along the way. But people have to remember that the underlying reason why all this occurred is because the cost of a solar PV system has crashed dramatically in the last 3 years. When people were talking about feed-in tariffs, 3 or 4 years ago, when they were designing the policies and the prices around them, it was completely normal to talk about an average solar PV system costing $14,000 or $15,000. And so people were trying to figure out, what was a level of support that would kind of help householders make that decision. How much upfront support or how much ongoing support do they need? Today, it's much more likely to talk about the same size system made, by the same people as being, more like $2,000 or $3,000. So when the price of something comes down, that dramatically, and partly the government schemes drove that reduction by kind of building the scale of the industry. Nobody anticipated that, not governments or oppositions or public servants, not the sector, not the opponents of renewable energy, not the supporters of renewable energy. I mean, nobody was predicting those kind of reductions. And some governments responded faster than others, and it was clearly a mistake in New South Wales that they didn't respond faster to those trends. But at the end of the day, the contribution to people's bills are a couple of dollars a month across the year. It's not the reason why people are struggling to pay their electricity bills. And we have to remember, in exchange for that, we've got a brand new industry that employs thousands of people, that's providing, quite significant quantities of clean energy. And those households that have installed solar, that's probably the single best thing they could have done to reduce their electricity prices. The problem is we need to spread the benefits of solar to more people rather than try to shut it down.
That's Tim Sonrach from the Clean Energy Council discussing the federal government's renewable energy target. Environmental NGOs are warning of the consequences of a new coal rush in Queensland. Greenpeace says that emissions from coal mined from the as-yet-untapped Galilee Basin would endanger the world's efforts to keep atmospheric greenhouse gas within safe limits. You're listening to The Third Degree, and we're joined now by Georgina Woods from Greenpeace Australia. Welcome to The Third Degree, George.
Thanks for having me.
Some of our listeners will be aware of the Alpha Coal mega mine that's been approved for the Galilee Basin just recently. It's co-owned by Gina Rinehart. But can you talk us through what else is looking likely to happen in the area?
Yeah, sure. There are, at the moment, 9 mega mines proposed for the Galilee Basin, which is an area in central Queensland that doesn't currently have any coal mining underway. Because the Galilee Basin is such a long way from the coast, the mines that are proposed to be built there are very, very large. 5 of the 9 mines would be larger than any of the coal mines currently in operation in Australia. And in order to export the coal from those mines to the port, 2 new rail lines will need to be built of hundreds of kilometres of rail across floodplain land in central Queensland. And in order to export the coal to Asia, there are several new coal terminals proposed to be built on the Great Barrier Reef coast. Now, what we have done is add up all of the proposals that are being put forward by the coal companies using their own figures and calculated that if all of these mines went ahead at maximum production, they would be responsible for creating 705 million tonnes of carbon dioxide every year.
These are big numbers. I mean, how does that stack up to, say, Australia's current carbon emissions?
Well, Australia's current carbon greenhouse gas emissions from all sources and all gases is around 560 million tonnes. So it's much larger than Australia's current greenhouse gas emission contribution. And what we did in our report was we compared the carbon dioxide that would be created from the Galilee Basin coal to the carbon dioxide pollution of the biggest emitting countries in the world that they create from burning fossil fuels. And in actual fact, the Galilee Basin coal, if it goes ahead at full production, would be the 7th biggest emitter of carbon dioxide from fossil fuel burning in the world.
What kind of impact is that likely to have on global carbon emissions targets and temperature rises, I suppose, around the world?
Yeah, well, we used modelling by the International Energy Agency of coal demand under different scenarios of avoiding dangerous climate change, and their scenario for limiting global warming to 2 degrees has global coal demand rapidly diminishing, quite quickly in the near future. So the proposal to continue expanding Australia's coal export industry is at odds with Australia's commitment to limiting warming to below 2 degrees. In fact, we think that exploiting the Galilee Basin is incompatible with that commitment. Now, if the world does miss that goal and we do see global warming of above 2 degrees, what we're being told by reef scientists this week is that essentially coral reefs around the world would be subject to annual bleaching, and many of them would be unable to survive the onslaught of the higher sea surface temperatures that would be the result of that warming.
And having obviously an impact on the Great Barrier Reef then?
Yeah, that's right. So the impact on the Great Barrier Reef of exploiting the Galilee Basin is twofold. Obviously, the Galilee Basin is contributing to the expansion of the coal industry, which is driving greenhouse gas emissions up, and that's driving dangerous climate change, which is a long-term threat to the reef. But in the immediate future, there are multiple new coal terminals proposed to be built in the Great Barrier Reef World Heritage Area, digging up seagrass habitat, interrupting the mating and feeding of dugongs and turtles, and dredging large amounts, millions of cubic metres of the seafloor, and potentially dumping them in the marine park. So we're seeing an unprecedented expansion of industrial development on the Great Barrier Reef coast, and this is despite calls from the international community that Australia not permit development that would impact on the outstanding universal value of the reef.
Look, I suppose one of the things that you've been saying in the report and while we've been speaking is if all of these mines are fully developed, if this basin is fully exploited. Now, how likely is that actually to happen? I mean, we've seen the Queensland and Commonwealth governments already, you know, they've faced off over the Alpha Coal Project for quite a while, you know, suggesting that it's not really a sure bet that all of these mines are going to go ahead. What do you think of that? I mean, do you think that all of these mines will be just given the green light, or is it a more complex picture?
The first enabling project of this development, as you said, the Alpha Coal Project, has already been given the green light by the Federal Environment Minister, Tony Burke. And that will make it much easier for the other mines to be developed because it's the Alpha Project that will have a 500-kilometre rail line that will transport coal to the coast. I think that from our perspective, the question of whether or not market forces determine whether or not these mines go ahead is not really the pertinent one today. If it's been shown that exploiting the Galilee Basin and expanding Australia's coal export industry is inconsistent with Australia's committed goal of limiting global warming to below 2 degrees, then the ball's really in the government's court to say, we acknowledge that coal exports are our biggest contribution to climate change and we're going to have to constrain the coal export industry from here on. It shouldn't be up to the vagaries of the market to determine whether or not Australia meets that international commitment. It's a very serious commitment. It's a very urgent commitment. And we'd be concerned if the government was throwing up its hands and saying, well, we're not sure whether we're going to be able to meet this commitment because maybe the price of coal will mean these lines go ahead, maybe it won't, and we're going to leave it up to the coal companies to determine whether or not we stand by our international commitments.
I suppose part of what's problematic with projects like this, and I suppose Australia's coal exports generally, is that they're not included in estimates of our emissions. Now, how then is Australia meant to have those international obligations enforced?
Yeah, that's right. That's one of the key failings of the system that's been identified in our report, is that currently Australia doesn't have the capacity to look at these kinds of proposals in light of the contribution that they make to climate change. That's obviously a pretty big omission, given the urgency of climate change and the huge contribution that the coal export industry is making. So we're calling for the government to acknowledge that the coal exports are our biggest single contribution to climate change and begin implementing measures that will enable them to ensure that we're not pursuing a course of development that is fueling global climate change. Under the international system, Australia isn't technically responsible for emissions that aren't created on our shores, but we don't think that exonerates Australia from considering the impact that this industry is having. It is a global problem and Australia needs to take a global approach. Our supply of coal is globally significant, and if Australia decided to constrain its coal export industry in the interest of tackling climate change, that would send a very positive and quite, you know, dramatically game-changing signal to the rest of the world about our seriousness about climate change.
The modelling that the Federal Bureau of Resource and Energy Economics has done about the projected growth of Queensland's coal industry, you know, has the industry in Queensland and the Galilee Basin growing at a much slower rate than has been predicted in your report, and that's something
yep.
that the Queensland Resources Council has sort of pointed to in their response
yep.
to the report today. What do you think of those predictions? How do you respond to that?
Well, we're not predicting an increase in the coal industry. We're simply adding up all of the proposals that the coal industry is currently making for new mines and ports in Queensland. So if the coal industry isn't intending to dig new mines and build these new ports, then they should take those proposals off the table. We think that the Federal Environment Minister should say no to the new coal terminals that are being proposed for the Great Barrier Reef Coast. What we have detailed in our report is not Greenpeace's prediction, it's not modelling, it's not an estimation, it is arithmetic of all of the proposals that are currently on the table from the coal industry. And the Queensland Resources Council would be well aware of the scale of development that's being proposed. It is an astounding scale of expansion that's currently on the table for the Queensland coal industry, and people are right to be shocked when they see the kind of numbers that are coming out in our report. But it's not us that's making these proposals, it's the coal industry. They are proposing to build a lot more mines and a lot more ports than the Bureau of Resource and Energy Economics is predicting. And we would be very glad to hear that the scale of expansion that's being proposed for Queensland is not going to go ahead. I think the pertinent point, though, would be that it's actually the government's responsibility to ensure that we're meeting our climate change commitments. And so they should be the ones that determine whether or not projects like this should go ahead. And we really need clarity from them, I suppose, in response to our report, whether or not they intend to let these projects go through.
What kind of thing is it going to take for the government to really take these mines off the table? I mean, we've already sort of discussed how, you know, the international community doesn't hold Australia really responsible for the emissions from this coal that's dug up here but burnt elsewhere. How is Australia's government going to be forced into or brought round into taking these projects off the table?
They do need to be forced into it, to be totally honest. We haven't seen any indication from the Australian government so far that they're taking seriously the contribution that coal exports make to climate change. So we really think that people who care about climate change need to make their views known to the government and need to start activating in the community against these projects, because there isn't that much time left to meet our climate change goals. And without a significant amount of pressure from the community and a holding to account for the commitments that we have made to avoid more than 2 degrees warming, we're afraid very much that the Australian government isn't serious about reducing our biggest single contribution to climate change, which comes from our coal exports.
That's Georgina Woods, Senior Climate and Energy Campaigner for Greenpeace Australia Pacific. That's all we've got at The Third Degree this week. Do enjoy your day and stay switched on to 2SER for The Daily, coming up next. ¶¶